Good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. It is now time for Greenside Up, as is every Wednesday. And in studio today, we have Jacob Weber and Wendy Powell from the K-State Extension Office. Guys, how are you doing today?
Very good. Good morning.
Well, Jacob, one of the things I asked you about before the show, which you'd like to talk about, you wanted to talk about some information on poinsettias.
Poinsettias. I mentioned them a week or two ago. And, of course, this is a very important potted plant because I guess it's the number one potted plants as far as money-making goes. Billions of dollars per year. And the poinsettia, of course, has quite a history. The poinsettia is named after a first ambassador from the United States to Mexico, Joel Robert Poinsett. Good name. Okay. Sometime in the early 19th century, around 1820, 1825, he sent the plant or collection of plants back to his home in, I think it's Charleston, South Carolina. I'm not sure. But and he grew them in his greenhouse. He's a botanist as well as a doctor, of course, back then. Doctors had to have a lot of study in botany because they used a lot of medicinal plants for their medication. But he grew that, and he gave it to some friends. And I think it was in 1829 that the first poinsettia was entered into a flower show somewhere back east. And didn't really go anyplace because it was a lanky, unbranched plant. It had various native or natural poinsettias are kind of nondescript, but they do have the colorful bracts. A lot of times they're fairly small. Poinsettias were used in Christmas pageants in Mexico in the 15th, 16th century by Franciscans, Franciscan priests in particular. But the tradition didn't really develop until the mid 20th century, about 1950, as a result of the Eck family in California taking the plant and discovering a method, a means of creating a branched plant with different characteristics and large colorful bracts and ability for that foliage to remain intact. So it acts as actually a foil. Those bracts are modified leaves. They're actually colored leaves below the cyanthium, the floral structure at the very end of the branches on the poinsettia. The poinsettia is in the spurge family and does produce a milky sap. But they discovered a technique to do this, and they kept it a secret for quite a number of years. And eventually, a researcher discovered a technique later on and published it. I think it was right in the 1980s that happened. And then, then they fessed up. Yeah, this is what they did. And it turns out that they would graft. There were populations of branching poinsettias. They would use that as a rootstock, and they would graft an unbranched cultivar on top of that use that as the rootstock and the scion, and somehow it transferred genetic information to the scion that produced a new plant with unusual characteristics, and from there they selected many of the modern cultivars. Well, turns out, that something like that, if you have a transmission of a genetic material or some type of material that interferes with the genetics of the scion, that means that there's a possibility that this is a disease. And later on, it was discovered, yes, it is a disease. It's a phytoplasm. It's an organism that will interfere with the genetic makeup of the scion, and it's transferred from the rootstock. And, of course, the results of the modern cultivars is a result of a little disease called a phytoplasm. And it doesn't hurt the plant. It actually makes it more attractive and more usable as a potted plant, as a holiday gift plant. And so that is the modern poinsettia cultivars that we have.
That's amazing to just think that a disease basically helped make this plant look like it does and act the way it does. Sometimes nature is amazing like that.
It is. Normally, phytoplasms can cause some bad effects, but in this case, it was a good effect. And, of course, once that transmission of the information occurred, then they could propagate the scion, and it would be permanent. It would be the new cultivars were multi-branching with different leaf characteristics and everything. And so now we got a very attractive holiday gift plant as a result.
Absolutely. And also there's a bowl named after it on San Diego, the Poinsettia Bowl have every year. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, Jacob, thank you very much for that. Wendy, first of all, welcome. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing great.
Well, Wendy, you wanted to talk about there's a series that's starting in January at the Wildcat Extension Center. Let's hear about it.
Yeah. So the Kent State Research and Extension is putting on a program called Farm Financial Skills for Women. And this program is going to be geared towards farm women that are working on their operations financials. And it starts in January. It's a four-session series. January 15th, 22nd, 29th, and then it rolls into February for the 5th, and then we have a snow date of the 12th. So what we're going to focus on here is cash flow sheets, how to read statements and make for sure that your operation is operating above board, or how to monitor those financials so that your operation can be successful. I don't know how much goes over the air about the stress that the farm industry is in, the farming and ranching industry, with low commodity prices. And so we're gearing this program towards people who are trying to keep their operations above board, keep them operating in times of these stressful situations so that we don't have too many of them going out of business and whatnot.
So, and again, that's going to be in, it's going to be all January, because you gave us several dates. It's basically the same, once a week, pretty much.
Yeah, it'll be every week for 4 weeks. Folks can sign up starting now, actually, at agmanager.com. There's a link on there to sign up for the Farm Financial Series. And deadline to sign up is December 30th. So that'll come up very quickly with the holidays happening. And so here in the Wildcat District, we're going to offer three different locations here. Well, in Montgomery County, it'll be up at Sycamore. Hopefully that'll be a good location for folks in Montgomery and Wilson counties to travel to. So Sycamore Township Hall. And then we're going to be doing one at the Parsons Research and Extension Center. They're on Highway 400 in Parsons. And then at the Hepler Community Building over in Hepler, Kansas. And these classes are going to be going on all across the state at the exact same time. So we're going to have farm economists on campus that are going to be broadcasting the program over video conferencing. And then we're going to have local topics in each classroom that will be in those nights. There's going to be in-person facilitators, of course. We're going to be providing dinner. There is a $40 fee for participants. We do have some scholarship options, though. So anybody that wants to sign up can send their $40 in and take part in these programs. And like I said, they're going to be broadcast over video conferencing, but there's going to be some activities that we'll be doing in person, some actual spreadsheets and whatnot that we'll be balancing, and there's going to be people on hand to help work through all of those questions. And so hopefully it won't be too daunting for people that are unfamiliar with those types of things.
So while you can watch it online and still get the program, it's almost preferable to kind of be there to be hands-on, correct?
Well, we're not. It won't be offered just for anyone. It'll have to, the participants will have to come to the location. Yeah. So we really would like for folks to be participating in all four sessions. They each build upon each other, and so it'd be difficult to miss one. So hopefully folks can be able to attend all four sessions at the centers.
So again, and there are three different areas and all happening at the same time. So you don't have to drive too far to get to one of these classes, correct?
Right. That was our plan.
And that's really good too. That way you don't have to drive too far. So you said one's going to be in Sycamore.
Sycamore.
The other one in Parsons. Mm-hmm. And the last one I couldn't remember offhand.
Hepler Community Center.
Okay. And yes. Where is that located at?
Crawford County.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it is east of Coffeyville.
Yes.
So if you're listening in Coffeyville, it is over that direction. So again, that series will be going on in January. Are there any other series coming up in the near future?
There's a few classes that we'll be offering. There's a farm succession planning program that James Coover is working on. And I don't know the date on that one. Do you, Jacob?
No, I don't.
Okay. So those will be all on our Wildcat District webpage also. And check our Facebook page for all kinds of offerings as well. We're planning some really great programs for this spring. Also, some prescribed burning information is going to be put out. I'm going to have some cattle health programs. Animal Health Night will be held here in Montgomery County, just like it always has in the past. So, yeah, lots of offerings for continuing education for farming and ranching producers.
Absolutely. I mean, it's end of the year, and even though there's holidays going on, you guys are still super busy with lots of things that y'all are putting together.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and one of the most popular questions is still coming across my desk, and it seems like it doesn't matter what time of year it is pasture leasing question. So in the springtime, producers are looking for grass, and in the fall, they're kind of wrapping up their contracts and looking for either better ways of doing those contracts or different places to move to. And landowners are reviewing those and making for sure that they're all above board and they're working for each party. So we have lots of resources on pasture leasing also. That's a huge, huge part of my program area.
So, yeah, you guys are definitely busy. How can they contact you again for if they want to attend one of these programs?
So my number at the Altamont office is 620-784-5337. And you can find any of us at the extension offices across the district. That'll be Fredonia, Independence, Altamont, and Girard. And we also have a very up-to-date website. That'd be wildcatdistrict.kstate.edu, I believe. And then our Facebook page is also very up-to-date.
So lots of information on all those locations, the website, the Facebook page. And it sounds like you guys are definitely on top of and making sure everybody's well-informed about all these classes and programs.
Yes.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and take a break. We'll have Fox News at the top of the hour, and then when we come back, we'll have more Greenside Up. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Welcome back to the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High in studio with you. Greenside Up is now back as we have Jacob Weber and Wendy Powell in from the K-State Extension Center. And Jacob, you wanted to talk about, before we headed to break, you wanted to talk about Sunscald.
Yeah, there we go. I'm on now. Sunscald injury. This is, you think about Sunscald as being really hot and burning during the summertime. It actually is a wintertime problem. And it's associated with certain types of trees and shrubs that, well, mainly trees, have thin bark, like cherry trees, fruit trees, maple trees, especially red maple. The young trees are very susceptible. And what happens is that during the winter months, especially when we get in mid and late winter, we have warm spells and mild temperatures for maybe a week or two, and we get an effect that causes the plant to start greening up, the cells in the trunk tissue, stem tissue, to start de-acclimating. Acclimation for wintertime occurs in late summer, early fall, and into the early and late fall and early winter months as a result of exposure to cold temperatures and also exposure to shorter day lengths. This is a natural process. But during the wintertime, and we have those warm spells, we get warming effect, especially in the afternoon time when the daytime temperatures are fairly warm. The warming effect of sunlight on that bark, on the trunk of the trees, is such that it causes that tissue to start to soften up. And that's okay if we have temperatures that gradually cool off during the winter months, stay cold, and then gradually warm up without those fluctuations. But when you get those extreme fluctuations where you have, you don't need a coat on, you just walk around in the middle of February, and it's really nice to be outside, and all of a sudden you have a real cold snap come in, temperatures drop down 20 degrees, maybe 15, 10 degrees, and that soft tissue on the southwest side of the plant freezes and it causes injury to that. It can actually even kill the tissue. If it's just merely injured, it's such that it's very a prime target for wood boring insects, flathead wood borer for the maple trees and apple trees. And they can injure the that side of the trunk, and you will see the effects maybe a year or two, 3 years down the road of this sun scald injury. If the tissue is dead, of course it stays intact. You don't notice it because it looks like normal bark. But two or three years later, as that tree is growing, the trunk expands in diameter, that dead bark starts to pop off. And you have a dead, exposed area on the southwest side of the tree. It's called sun scald injury. This can be prevented. The primary way of preventing it is just to simply to shade the trunk to protect it from that afternoon exposure to sunlight on those warm days. And craft paper wrap on the trunk usually works, usually sufficient. This is put on in the fall when the leaves come off of the tree, and it's taken off again the following spring when the buds start to swell. Putting other materials around the trunk of the tree can also work, but you want to make sure that it does not girdle the trunk. In other words, if you leave them in place all the time, such as those plastic spirals, that can actually cause the tree to die from strangulation. We'll call it strangulation, girdling, if they're not removed, because that material simply does not stretch sufficiently as the trunk increases in diameter. I use a cardboard tube around the trunk of my cherry tree. It has worked very well. I basically leave it on most of the time just to protect the trunk of the tree. As the bark gets thicker on the tree, it becomes less susceptible to sun scald injury, although that still can happen even on older trees. I've seen one situation where a couple of trees were growing very close to each other, and one of the trees had to be removed. It happened to be on the southwest side of the other tree, and that sudden exposure that following winter to the sunlight caused significant sun scald injury on an older tree. Which can happen unexpectedly. Of course, in that situation, there wasn't a whole lot the person could do about it to prevent it. Forest situations, when you have good company of other trees, you get that natural protection from the canopies of the trees, the branches and all the twigs and everything, give that sufficient shade that it doesn't hurt to have unprotected trunks at that time. things that you can do to prevent sun scald injury other than wrapping the trunk of the tree is keep a low skirt on the tree. Keep the tree, a low skirt means that the branches on the trunk are closer to the ground, and so you get the natural shading effect of the twigs and branches on the trunk of the tree. Keep the tree in good health. Keep it growing vigorously when it's young. So if there is a little bit of injury, it will recover fairly quickly, and eventually the tree develops a good thick bark that protects the inner bark tissue. The inner bark tissue is the living tissue, the phloem and the cambium. And then that protection keeps the tree in good health.
All right. Well, James, we have a call here, so let's go ahead and get to the phones. And caller, you are on Green Side Up. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. How are y'all doing?
Very well.
Jacob, I've got a question for you. I've got hydrangea, and what I did over the weekend, last weekend, I went over to Ace and picked up some aluminum sulfate, I think is what it's called. I might be wrong. Aluminum something.
Aluminum sulfate, yes.
Okay, to try to hopefully cause it to be blue next year. Now, I put some of that around the base of the trunk and such, and also put a little bone meal on it, because I figure it takes a long time for that bone meal to break down, doesn't it?
Yes, but putting it on the surface is probably not going to do a whole lot of good. Putting it into the soil can damage the roots. So aluminum sulfate, aluminum sulfate has a very powerful acidifying effect, and definitely will help increase the chances of producing the blue bracts on the big leaf hydrangea. This typically should be done prior to planting. Work thoroughly into the soil and work it into the entire root zone, expected root zone of the plant itself, and it's done at a specific rate, so follow label directions. Putting it on the soil surface, you could probably sprinkle it on a little bit every year over the entire root zone, not just at the base of the plant, because then you're concentrating everything in one spot, and that could be injurious to the roots itself at that spot. But broadcasting it evenly over the soil, I don't have a specific rate for you to apply. I would have to do a little research to find that out, what specific rate would be suggested. You could use sulfur every year as well. Sulfur is a little bit slower, 1 tablespoon per square yard per year over the root zone until you start getting that nice blue effect would be okay. See what happens next year from your application. If you don't get the blue bracts next year, just keep adding a little bit every year, and it'll slowly work into the soil over a period of time, help acidify the soil. Don't expect a whole lot from this single application this year. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, caller. We appreciate you calling here on a Green Side Up. I want to take things back over to Wendy real quick. And Wendy, before the break, you talked about pasture leasing. Can you expound on that a little bit more?
Sure. So pasture leasing is a huge topic because there's a lot of money involved with some of those situations. And there's not more land being made. So it's a very prominent discussion among producers are needing extra land for their operations. So landowners want to make for sure that what they're offering is fair to the tenants, and tenants need to make for sure that they are managing that land in a fair way. So having that agreement that both parties are above or on board with each other on the same page is very, very important. So in order to make that happen, some discussions need to happen between the landowner and the tenant, and I always encourage folks to do a written agreement. And this doesn't have to be something that's fancy or has a lot of words in it. It just needs to be an outline of everyone's expectations. You know, when you're going to put livestock into the pasture, when you're going to take them out, who is going to care for the livestock, check them every day or check them regularly, count how many's there, Who's going to maintain the fences? Who's going to maintain the watering systems? Even if it's a pond, there is some maintenance that still needs to happen with those ponds. Livestock watering ponds need to have some eyes upon them occasionally. And some other factors to throw in there. Who's going to be monitoring the pasture condition? So if you've got a lot of livestock on there and they're eating quite a lot, or if it becomes a drought season or extra rain like we've had this year, who is going to be keeping an eye on the pasture condition? That needs to be outlined in your written contract or agreement, however you'd like to call it. We have some examples at the Extension Office of these contracts and agreements that can walk you through those processes. And they have a lot of the factors listed on there. And of course, if you want to add your own, you can. But these are some ideas for you to be thinking about as you come to an agreement with a landowner or with a tenant to keep track of the pasture. And make for sure that everyone is on the same page. When these agreements go south, when these verbal agreements go south, things really get hairy, but for both parties, and bad feelings can be had, and they can be alleviated at the front end. Another reason to do written contracts, if one party or another somehow is eliminated from the picture for whatever reason, and some other party has to step in to fulfill one end or the other of that contract, if it's a verbal agreement, then that third party coming in might not know all of the fine details that could become important, like when to move the cattle out of the pasture. So it's very important that it's written and that family members or whoever might be stepping in as a third party knows where that contract is at, so that it can be found and relationships can be kept above board and no one has hard feelings.
Absolutely. And it kind of is like a, you know, like you said, it's kind of like a landlord tenant thing with apartments. You want all that verbiage down so that that if something goes south, that you can say, hey, this is what it says in this contract.
Sure. Yeah. So there's lots of different ways you can operate those. You can rent an acre, you know, dollar per acre or dollar per head. But all of that just needs to be discussed. You know, whenever you're doing a dollar per acre or dollar per head, it might be incentive for the tenant to overstock, whereas the landowner does not want quite that many head on the pasture to preserve the pasture, you know, preserve that grass that's there. So coming to a full agreement is very important. Having that stocking rate written out, and it might fluctuate throughout the year depending on the grass height. And this can be for any type of livestock, cattle, sheep, goats, horses, any type of livestock that's moving on to pasture land that's not owned by the person who owns the livestock. There's also situations where if a landowner has land, then maybe they want to lease the animals. So if somebody has extra animals, they're looking for a place to go, and someone wants some experience managing some animals, then maybe you look at the situation where you're leasing the animals. And that kind of does things just a little bit the opposite of what a landowner or a pasture lease would be. It would be an animal lease instead of a pasture lease. So there's several different ways you can look at it. And all of it comes down to, when you boil it down, agreement for both parties, whichever works for both parties, and have it written down.
Absolutely. And it looks like we got another call, so let's go ahead and get to the phone lines. Caller, you're on Green Side Up. How are you doing this morning?
Yeah, I was wondering if it was too late to plant a cover crop on a garden, and what kind of cover crop would Jacob recommend?
Okay, cover crop, essentially, you're not too late. You might have to put on a little extra seed. The most common cover crop would be a cereal grain crop such as wheat. You could, I don't know if rye would work very well.
Hey, caller, for one second, can you turn your radio down, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Wheat would be very good crop. 2 to 3 pounds per 1,000 square foot should do it. 2 to 3 pounds per 1,000 square foot. How many? 40 times 40 and 40.
Okay. I need to work 80. It in the garden. Work it into the soil.
Just scatter it on the surface and work it in to about a couple inches deep. just run over with rototiller or rotary tiller. Rototiller is a copy brand or protected word. So, rotary tillage equipment. You could do that, or you could just rake it in, hoe it in, and then it needs a little bit of water. But it is getting a little bit late in the season, so I'd say around 3 pounds. Per 1,000 square foot. It's fairly easy to find out. You could also plant some what's called radish, the field radish. There's another name for it. But the seed is probably hard to find. So wheat seed, bin run wheat seed is fine. Easy to get a hold of. You know, a farmer or somebody that has some, and you know, they work out your purchase agreement with them. Yeah, maybe switch a apple pie or something for a couple pounds. Okay. All right. All right. Bargain in kind. Okay?
Okay. All right. That sounds very good. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
All right. Thank you very much, caller. We definitely appreciate it. And that's going to wrap us up today here on Green Side Up. I thank you, Jacob and Wendy, for coming in today. And happy Thanksgiving to both of you.
Same to you.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will have open lines right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF.
Good Friday morning. I'm Sam Speck with your latest market information right here on the Mid-America Ag Network. We'll get to-